opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
And good morning and welcome to this April 4th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org and we are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on that later in the hour. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. We are doing both memoir and fiction this morning, but the fiction was sort of based on some personal experiences, so I'm going to talk with Erica Garza now about the memoir form, and in the second half to Jennifer Haupt about fiction and what gave her experience that a memoir could not. So that'll be a rich hour. There are so many kind of deep and different conversations that we're going to have this morning, so I'm really excited. First, Erica. Erica Garza's essays have appeared in Time, Glamour, Health, Bust, Good Housekeeping, The Cut, The Los Angeles Review, Salon. She holds an MFA in nonfiction writing from Columbia University. She was born in Los Angeles to a Mexican father and a Mexican-American mother and has spent the majority of her adult life traveling and living abroad. Getting Off, her memoir on sex addiction, is her first book. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Erica, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks for coming on. So I'm going to give you a chance to take us inside your book, and then we can kind of use that as a platform to jump off and talk about it, but sort of talk about the genesis of the book and what our reader is going to find inside.
Okay, yeah. So Getting Off chronicles my two-decade journey through sex and porn addiction, and it was a way that I traced the roots of that addiction, how it all began, how it worsened over time, and how I eventually found my way out of it, which was not a linear path by any means. It was a very windy road, and I used a lot of different methods to climb out of that addiction. It was really important for me to show in this book that there were many ways that addiction could begin, and I think that, you know, there's a lot of ideas about what sex addiction must be preceded by, especially for women. There's all this talk of, you know, incest or rape or some kind of sexual trauma, but I really wanted to broaden the conversation a bit more to show that, you know, because my childhood was actually pretty stable and mediocre and normal, no huge trauma or anything like that. And I also wanted to show that there are many ways to step out of addiction, that it's not just, you know, I found God or 12-step or something and lived happily ever after. So it was a way for me to really open up the conversation a bit more. That was my goal in writing the book.
I think this is such an important book because it's a topic that is so underrepresented in literature. And I always think it's important to talk about the time that a book is born into, and I think the timing of when this book is coming out and sort of the crux of the Me Too movement, and as we're having all these collective conversations about sexual power and sex abuse and harassment and rape, this is a very different but really important piece of that conversation, I think, of how women use sex to enslave themselves, maybe, or how our culture is so steeped in these expectations of for women and of women that maybe women buy into that narrative and enslave themselves. I don't know. Talk a little bit about how you see the place the book is born into and what it's contributing to the collective talk.
You know, I couldn't have imagined when I was writing the book that all of the Me Too movement was going to be happening at the same time. You know, I started writing the book in 2014, and writing on this topic, which eventually became this book, and then I got the book deal in 2016, and so then there was a huge delay, and it wasn't until the, you know, Me Too movement happened, and then my book's publication was around the same time, so it wasn't anything that was expected at all. It was just crazy timing. But, you know, I think that one of the things that I often think about is that women are now speaking about things that they've previously silenced or felt ashamed about. And I think that we are experiencing a huge cultural shift where that silence is being broken and women are feeling more comfortable in coming forward and speaking about these delicate subjects. And so, yeah, I'm just glad to be part of that and contributing to the conversation in any small way.
Yeah. Tell me about what the writing of it gave you. Like, did the act of and the experience of writing the memoir change anything for you? Did it make you view the situation differently or give you more understanding of kind of what you went through?
It was a really huge part of the healing process for me. It was a way for me to extend compassion to not just other people that I had, you know, blamed for a lot of different negative experiences in my life, but also a way to extend compassion for myself and to make peace with some of those more delicate areas of my past. And just to get some clarity on what had actually happened. And I was also able to conduct some research into, you know, other women who are addicted and, you know, how technology affects addiction and how culture affects addiction and lots of different areas that just helped me gain a better understanding. And I was hopeful that I would be able to pass on what I had learned to other people who were feeling the same way as me. And then publishing the book itself was another big part of the healing process, because it was a way for me to connect with other people who were going through similar struggles. You know, I received messages since the book came out nearly every day from people who have felt so alone and so ashamed for a really long time and felt like they were more broken than everybody else. And, you know, they should just keep quiet about this. And you know, and I don't think anything fuels addiction more than shame and silence. And so hearing from those people, it made me feel like I was contributing something important in helping them, but also hearing from them helped me. And it was important for me to hear that, because addiction is isolating and there's nothing better than having connection with another person.
That's so funny. Your answer touched on like 8 questions that I had. So we'll unpack a lot of your answer, that, which is great. But so at what point in the process did you know you were going to write about this? Because you've been a writer your whole life. I mean, you were a journaler by the sounds of reading the memoirs since you were a kid. And I know writing was a part of your life since childhood and early high school. So at what point did you say to yourself, this is a story that I need to tell? And then at what point did you start working on it?
Yeah, I was keeping journals since I was, I think, 7 years old. And it's so funny because I've kept all of those journals. So to look back at them is just a trip. So I had always turned to writing as a therapeutic tool, you know, as a source of comfort and just to, you know, understand what I was going through and, you know, what I wanted. And it always was a big part of my life. And it wasn't, but it was always a very private activity. It wasn't until it was 2014 when I really started to, I got my MFA at Columbia. So I was starting to, you know, think about becoming a writer as a career. And then I was doing, you know, some food reviews and writing some little essays here and there. But I wasn't writing about sex addiction until 2014. So I wrote my first essay on that for Salon. It was called Tales of a Female Sex Addict. And that was really scary. And, you know, it wasn't something that I shared on Facebook or Twitter, you know, where my family would read it. It still felt kind of private to me, but of course it was public because I put it out there and it was on the internet. But the messages that I received from people was just so uplifting, you know, and it's like I was saying with writing the book, I felt like I was contributing something important, and I was hearing from people who they were so grateful that I was writing about this, and I wanted to continue doing that. And also it was important for me to talk about things that I had kept secret for a long time. And I was already doing that kind of work in my personal life by going to 12-step meetings and in therapy and, you know, intimate spaces like that. But I thought the next step and the more empowering part of it would be to take that to a public level and see what it felt like to reveal those kind of secrets in a public arena. And, you know, and it was a way for me to take away the power of those secrets that they had over me. Just revealing it and talking about it was incredibly helpful.
That's a great point. Yeah, I do think that kind of demystifying things and putting it out there and owning it, then it's not as scary, right? I mean, once you're hiding behind something, it just feels bigger and scarier than it really is. And
You put it out there and then it's like, well, now what? You know, it doesn't hurt anymore. So then you get to shift your focus to other things in your life that you've been neglecting because you've been obsessing about this one thing for so long.
Yeah.
It's really a way to relieve yourself of that work.
Right. Good point. And what a treasure trove to have all of these journals so that you could go back and see what you were thinking at particular times. Because, when you know, your memory plays so many tricks on you when you go back and look at things versus when you read about what you were thinking at the moment you wrote it. That had to have been a great resource for you in just triggering memories of what happened.
It really was, and it was a way for me to remember things that I had forgotten or that I had remembered in a different way than they actually happened, and then to go back and read it again and say, oh, okay, that's how it really happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that was part of the process of, like I said before, extending compassion to people and forgiving people, because in my head I had, you know, held some resentments for some people, and it was a way for me to make peace with them.
Right, right. So before we get into the nitty-gritty parts of writing the book, which is what our show is supposed to devote itself to, I'm just also curious if you, having come through this process, feel like there's a healthy place for porn in our culture, either for men or for women. Is there a healthy way to consume it?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I mean, I think a lot of people might think, just based on the title of my book, or, you know, hearing that it's a book about overcoming sex addiction and porn addiction, that it's an anti-porn book, and that is not the case whatsoever. You know, I still watch porn to this day, and that was part of my journey. At the very beginning of my recovery, I thought that, you know, I could never watch porn again. I was going to be in this strict monogamous relationship and never explore outside of the bounds of that. And I was very strict with myself and set up a lot of boundaries. And I think that in the beginning, that was important for me because it allowed me the space and time to work on, you know, what I needed to work on in my past and to feel my feelings again, basically, because I'd been numbing myself for a long time. But after a while, it started to feel a bit inauthentic, and I realized that I still wanted to be a sexual person. I still wanted to be open-minded and experimental. I just didn't want to lie to the people I loved anymore. I didn't want to sabotage meaningful relationships. I didn't want to hurt myself. So it's really about achieving balance. And absolutely, I think that people can watch porn and they don't need to take it to, you know, the extreme level that I took it to. I think that if you start to binge on porn or use it as an escape route, then maybe that's something for you to look at and to consider, you know, are you using porn in an unhealthy way? But that's for each person to figure out on their own.
Yeah, good point. My guest this morning is Erica Garza. The book is Getting Off, One Woman's Journey Through Sex and Porn Addiction. It's interesting because often the time when I'm talking to memoirists or any fiction, any writer, often the parts that the reader thinks would have been the most difficult to write are not the parts that the writer found the most difficult to write. And as I was reading this, I would read passages and think, oh my gosh, that must have been, you know, it's particularly vulnerable or painful, must have been really hard. But then when, you know, I'm curious to hear the hard parts of this for you versus the seemingly hard parts. What were the hardest parts to get to, and kind of how did you overcome that?
You know, the hardest parts for me in looking back were the parts that didn't have to do with sex at all. You know, were the parts with my childhood where I was talking about my family members. You know, I mentioned my brother, my cousins, and my parents especially. Those scenes took a lot out of me. I had to write them over and over to make sure that I was being fair to them. You know, I didn't want anybody to get the impression that I was placing blame on them, you know, or you know, holding resentment for them. And I didn't want them to feel bad when they read it. You know, there were lots of those ideas floating around in my head. And so, I would say that was the most difficult part. When it came to the actual sex scenes, I would think people would think that those, especially the more explicit scenes, maybe those were really difficult to write. But surprisingly, they weren't.
See, you're another example of what I was doing. It's always the way, and it's always the family that's the hardest to write about.
Yeah, it's tough to write about family.
It is. So did you interview your family for their kind of memories of what had happened, or did you give them any, not authority or license over what to keep in and what to take out, but how much involvement did your family have?
No, I would say they had very little involvement. I mean, I had mentioned, no, they weren't even sure that I, they weren't, they didn't know I was sorry. They didn't know I was writing the book, so I didn't interview them or even tell them what I was up to. It wasn't until the book was going to be published, and you know, you have to go through some drafts before it actually hits the printer, that I had mentioned some scenes that were in the book. Not so much to say, is this okay with you, but just so they knew what was coming.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
One of the aspects of this I love is the research. So the book, I was a former lawyer, so I'm so familiar with footnotes. So the book has a lot of wonderful footnotes that really just inform your experiences against research experiences. And one of them that I, well, there are a couple of them that struck me, but video gaming, I didn't realize, is it kind of goes in tandem with porn addiction. I just had been blind to that, but after you said it, it kind of made sense. But tell me a little bit about your research process and how, so as you were writing the book, I don't know, how did that go? You would look up articles that would kind of relate to what you were talking about, or tell me a little bit how the research and integrating that into the narrative went for you.
So the research part of it I did after I'd already written the narrative. It was a way for me to, just explore, to see if I was really the only person who felt like this, or if really my problems just, you know, came out of thin air. It was a way for me to show that, you know, there's a bigger picture here, that there were bigger contributing factors to why things turned out the way they turned out. And if that happened for me, then it must be that way for a lot of people. And I think, you know, like I said, there's a lot of people who feel like addiction is incredibly isolating, that they're the only ones going through this. And I think that looking up research and seeing, no, there are lots of different reasons why this happened and lots of other people who feel this way, I think that's a helpful thing for people who are feeling all alone.
For sure. For sure. And it really added another dimension to the book. I mean, it gave it just an added layer of intrigue, and you know, gone
thank
back
you.
To look up some of these articles.
I was hopeful. Yeah, I hoped that was going to be the case. They're originally inside of the text, but then we changed it to footnotes in the end.
Yeah,
which I'm glad. I think it works better that way.
Works better that way. Yeah, for sure. I mean, you can read it as kind of in real time. That if it was at the end, I don't think I'd go back and spend the time that I did if it was right in the text. So that was great. And then I want to talk about the, like, constructing the narrative, because there are real life events, but then you have to still construct a story and a narrative with themes and refrains and character arcs and all of that. So let's kind of unpack that process of how to take the mounds of material of your life and whittle them down into a narrative arc. That's a big question. So maybe we can start with kind of point of entry.
Yeah, I don't know how to answer that.
Yeah, so I'll help you. So maybe we can start with kind of point of entry and point of exit, and kind of determining the frame of the book and how you settled on that, on where to enter the story and where to exit the story, and then we'll keep going from there.
Okay. So one of the biggest themes of the book is shame. And so I started at a point where I tried to remember, you know, what was my first source of shame, at least that I could remember. And for me, it was my upbringing, my ethnicity. And so I began with, you know, my neighborhood, which is a predominantly Latino neighborhood, and of course with my family, a Mexican-American family. And so I really wanted to unpack what exactly about that made me feel ashamed, and is that shame related to the shame that I later felt with my sexuality? And that was a way for me to see how culture influenced my addiction. And I was also in a Catholic upbringing, so how did religion affect my addiction? And so starting at that point, I was a preteen, was a good entry point, I think, for me to get into the whole dynamic there at play with family and culture and religion.
We have this whole debate in my writers group about prologues. Yours is called a prelude, but prologues or preludes or introductions. And yours, I thought, was just incredibly effective. And I don't even know why we debate it anymore, but everybody's like, I don't know about, you know, do we put in a prologue? Is it distracting? But I thought in this case, it was so wonderful to give sort of a quick insight into kind of one of the, you know, lower points of the story, and kind of have that framework set in the reader's mind before you then kind of go back and as you say, enter this place of where does shame start and how does shame inform itself in childhood and all of that. And I don't know if the prelude was always there, but I just thought it was incredibly an effective way to introduce the reader to both to the content and to where the story was going to go.
Yeah, I guess the prelude was really a way to show all of the things at play, all the negative things at play in my addiction, this lack of intimacy, this craving for sexual release and sexual attention, the loneliness of it, the compulsion of it. It was a way for me to tie in all of those different themes that had to do with my addiction in one compact little piece. And then a way for people to read it and say, well, how did she get to this point? And, okay, well, let's go back then and retrace her steps. But, yeah, I would say that was one of the more darker parts of my addiction and a good scene to point to illustrate that.
Yeah, exactly. Did you use outlines when you were writing, or did you write the book and then kind of outline it in the aftermath and say, okay, here's what needs to stay and here's what needs to go?
I can't say that I used an outline, actually, no. Okay. I just sort of wrote it as is.
Yeah, yeah.
That would have been really helpful, though.
I mean, because
next book.
Yeah, next book, right. It does feel like when you look at it, it's such a clean arc and a clean, I mean, I know it would be a story of character change, so you naturally would have a character arc going through, you know, from dark to light. But I don't know, it felt very intentional, and I was wondering kind of the process that brought about that intentionality, or if it just lovingly came out this way in a wonderful way.
Yeah, it just sort of came out that way. Just sticking with that theme of, you know, where did shame begin? How did it get worse? And how did I grow in response to that?
Yeah. What a lovely gift to have the story kind of given to you in that way. I mean, I hear authors all the time say, oh, I had, you know, 300 pages of stuff that just, it didn't make sense. And it was an interesting anecdote, but it just didn't fit in with the storyline and I had to let it go. But it sounds like that wasn't really the case for you, that it was a much, much easier process.
Yeah, it was actually a surprisingly easy process. I don't know if that'll happen again in my career. I hope it does. But even as far as cutting things out, I mean, I didn't really even have to cut that much out or edit that much out. I feel like it was just a story that I needed to tell, like a story that I had been living in my head for so long, that just naturally came out the way it was supposed to come out.
Yeah, nice. My guest this morning is Erica Garza. The book is Getting Off, One Woman's Journey Through Sex and Porn Addiction, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We've already touched on this quite a bit, or you have, but I always enjoy talking about the reception the book has received and the conversations that it started, and it sounds like there's a lot to talk about there. But there's the book on your computer, the book in your head, and then there's the book in the world, and that's always kind of a different book almost. And so let's keep talking about that, the book in the world and how it may have changed the way you see the book you once saw in your head or on your own private computer screen.
I'm really proud of the book that is out in the world. I think that it is contributing something important and that people are responding to it in a way that I just hadn't imagined. You know, I was really preparing myself for a lot of backlash and for the trolls on the internet and for my parents to be upset and, you know, all the negative, the worst case scenarios that we do. But, you know, it's been overwhelmingly positive, and I feel like people are relating to it, whether they are addicted or not. And so I'm just glad to be contributing something important and meaningful.
It's so relatable. I mean, whether or not you struggle with sex and porn addiction, it specifically, so many of the emotions are universal emotions. And so I can see readers connecting to this so readily. And your bravery in sharing the story and, you know, all of that, I think, are just such resonant, wonderful things that readers would grip onto and cheer you on.
Thanks.
That's great.
Yeah, brave is a word they use a lot. At the beginning, I was like, well, what's so brave about it? You know, I'm just talking about some things that happened. And I always thought that bravery meant, you know, you aren't scared at all. And I felt pretty scared putting it out there. But then I realized that, you know, bravery is actually, it's okay. It's being scared, but doing it anyway, yeah. You know, taking the chance and talking about things that even if it feels scary to talk about, still doing it. And so, yeah, I guess it is brave. Thank
it
you.
It is brave. And, you know, I mean, to point out how brave it is, you have so many people responding to it saying this is obviously is a huge thing nobody is talking about, and you're talking about it, and you know, and all these people are responding to it. So, you know, it's a huge issue that is under discussed, and so yeah, congratulations. That's really wonderful.
Thanks. I really hope that people do start to discuss it more. I think that, you know, women especially have felt like they can't talk about this subject at all, and that, you know, makes people think that sex addiction isn't a real thing and it doesn't actually happen to women, and we get all sorts of false statistics. And so hopefully, you know, other women will read this and feel like they can talk about this and get help if they need help, and, you know, it'll open that up a little more.
The rules for men versus women across sex in every category across sex is astounding. So it's frustrating. But so I always love to have you leave us with a little bit of writerly advice, things that you learned throughout the process that could help folks working on their own memoirs or writing in general.
You know, one of the best things that somebody had said to me or I had heard somewhere is write as if, you know, nobody, like you don't have parents. I think that's what it is. Sorry. I totally butchered that. But write as if you don't have parents. There were a lot of parts when I was writing the book where I thought, you know, what if my parents read this? And, you know, should I do this? Is this going to, am I committing social suicide here? But I would say just do it anyway. Write it for yourself. Don't think about who's going to read it, where you'll get it published. And, you know, do it for you and do it because it's something that feels good to you and feels important to you. And then once you have that, then you can pretty much take it anywhere.
That's great advice. And tell us where we can find you online so we can stalk you online.
Yeah, please stalk me online. I love to also receive messages through my website, which is ericagarza.com. And you can find me on Twitter / Erica D. Garza.
Are you doing any book tours with this? Or are you all done with that?
I did a few readings here in L.A., but have a conference in Pasadena or a literary festival coming up pretty soon.
Okay.
But, yeah, that's pretty much it for now. Just lots of different interviews and podcasts and things like that. But it's all kind of quieting down, at least it has in the last few weeks. So I don't know what the future holds.
I thought because you were kind of in our backyard that, there would be opportunities to see you. So check you out and see if the Pasadena Literary Festival is not that far from us. So we'll look for you there if we need to find you.
Please do.
Wonderful. Erica, thank you so much. This is a huge pleasure.
Thank you so much.
That was Erica Garza, the book Getting Off, One Woman's Journey Through Sex and Porn Addiction. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Awesome, awesome read. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Jennifer Haupt will be here for the second half hour. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We are streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. We are on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads. There are hundreds and hundreds. Actually, this month, I can't believe I haven't announced this. This month, we are celebrating 20 years on the air. So if you do the math and you multiply 52 times 2 times 20, I can't do math, but it's a lot of shows. So if you go up on our website, there are hundreds and hundreds of interviews up there. You can also follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. There's no way not to follow us, really. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone, onward with the show. Jennifer Haupt is has been a journalist for more than 25 years, writing primarily about women prompted by their own depression and grief to reach out and help others to heal. Her essays and articles have been published in O, the Oprah magazine, The Rumpus, Psychology Today, Travel and Leisure, The Seattle Times, Spirituality and Health, many, many other publications, The Sun included. Her Psychology Today blog, One True Thing, is a collection of essays contributed by and interviews with best-selling and emerging authors. I have followed her for a long time on Facebook, so I am so excited she has a book out and we have a chance to talk about it. It is In the Shadow of 10,000 Hills. It's her first novel. It's published by Central Avenue, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on, Marie.
A long overdue chat for us, so I'm really excited about this. So I'm going to let you introduce the book. It's brand new out. It just came out, I think, 2 days ago was its pub date. So I'm going to guess that most of our listeners haven't yet read it. So I'm going to let you kind of take us into the story, and we'll push off from there.
Okay. This is actually my least favorite question because I hate describing my book.
I know.
I just feel like saying, just read it, and then let's talk about it. But it's basically the story, the intertwining story of three women who are searching for family and personal peace against the backdrop of post-genocide Rwanda. And I spent a month in Rwanda as a journalist, and I discovered not only so many stories that I wanted to share with people, but also a connection that I personally felt with genocide survivors over grief, over emotions that even though I certainly haven't gone through the trauma that they have gone through, I felt a connection over similar feelings. And I just wanted to share that with readers and in a way that was personal for me. As a Jew whose relatives were murdered in the Holocaust, and as a woman whose sister died when I was young, and I felt the grief of that for my entire life, I felt a connection with these people that I really didn't expect to feel, something more than just, I can never understand what they went through, but I can share the emotional space with them. So that's kind of what I was trying to do in this book.
So you went over to Rwanda to work on stories that I understand then kind of fell apart, and then you just spent time there on your own working on a story of your own. How did that
go? It was interesting for me because I really didn't know why I was going to Rwanda. I was 45, and I was kind of going through my first midlife crisis. And so that was 11 years ago, almost 12 years ago. And so when my story fell apart, the first week I was in Kigali, I hired a guide to take me into the foothills of Rwanda. And I went to about a dozen, I spent 2 weeks and went to about a dozen memorial sites. And these are churches and schools where there's a woman who is a guide there, who was given this job as kind of compensation for the fact that her family and most of the village members were murdered at this site. And so what was interesting to me is I was always the only person at these memorial sites. Mm. And like I said, as a Jew who'd been to Dachau in Germany, which is a huge museum and visited by thousands of people each year, a very clean and pristine place, the experience of going to these memorial sites, being the only person there, and seeing bullet holes in the ceilings and rust stains on the walls and bones stacked on shelves of anonymous victims, it all felt very real and it felt very personal. It sort of connected me with my past and connected me with a grief I felt over losing my sister when I was younger. So I wanted to share not just stories of genocide survivors, but also the main character in my book, Rachel, is a white woman who goes to Rwanda to find the father who abandoned her 30 years earlier. And she's grieving, and she's grieving for a piece of her heart that she feels her father took when he left, the piece that knows how to love like a mother and like a wife. So I wanted to take readers into my space as well as tell some of these stories of genocide survivors that I felt were not being shared.
Refresh our memory on history as to when you were there was how long after the genocide happened.
Oh, thank you for asking that question. So the genocide happened in 1994, and basically in Rwanda there's two main tribes, the Hutus and the Tutsis. The other tribes, the smaller tribes, have all been wiped out. And the government embarked on a fake news campaign that basically pitted the Hutus against the Tutsis and stirred up this big sort of pandemonium about the Tutsis are trying to take away our power and they're godless and God wants us to kill them. And the Hutus who did not take part in this campaign were also murdered. So it was a matter of you either take part in this campaign of killing your neighbors or you get killed yourself. And so that was 1994. My novel takes place in 2000 when the government was started to let a lot of the Hutu war criminals or alleged war criminals free from jail because the jails were so overcrowded. Mm-hmm. And there was a system of community trials that was going on. And the goal of these was for the Tutsis to find forgiveness for the Hutus who had murdered their families and enable these two tribes to live together again. And so I went 12 years after the genocide. And when I went, I was surprised that the genocide was still so fresh in the minds of everyone and in the land and in the air. And the government had this party line of reconciliation, and people's identity cards were, you know, were taken away, and everyone was supposed to be one tribe. But when I spoke with people, with genocide survivors in private, they told me, you know, of course, forgiveness really isn't possible, and you have to find a way to move on and find a sort of peace when forgiveness is impossible. So the theme of my book is really finding grace, a secular grace that has nothing to do with religion, when forgiveness isn't possible.
What did fiction give? Did you ever consider writing this as a nonfiction account? And what did fiction give this book that you feel like nonfiction couldn't have done?
I did not consider writing it nonfiction because, first of all, Philip Gorovitch did such a great job in his book of accounts of genocide survivors. And honestly, I didn't feel like I could do it justice. I didn't feel like I could, by telling these stories, the purpose of, well, let me back up. So what I wanted to do really was create a bridge between cultures. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to create a story that showed different people from different cultures finding family together in an unusual way. Uh-huh. So my story involves three women from three different generations. One is a white woman in her mid-30s from New York. One woman is a 19-year-old Tutsi woman coming back to Rwanda for the trial of some of her neighbors who had participated in murdering her family. And one of the women is a black woman in her early 50s who went to Rwanda because she was grieving after the death of Martin Luther King, and she grew up in the civil rights era in Atlanta. And she, in fact, had an interracial affair with Rachel's father. So that's why he winds up leaving their home, is to go find the love of his life in Africa. So it's these people sort of finding family in interesting ways.
Yeah.
And that was the goal of what I wanted to do. And obviously I could only do that with fiction.
Right, right. So I want to get into this topic of cultural appropriation and writing from another person's point of view. So there's this campaign I just discovered within the last couple of weeks called #OwnVoices. And I haven't fully researched this, so I don't want to speak out of turn here, but the gist of it is that white people writing from a person of color's point of view is problematic. And so I just wanted to talk a little bit about you taking on another person's point of view. I just having a hard time wrapping my mind around this, because I feel like if that's the rule, it's going to be very difficult to write any fiction whatsoever. But
well,
go ahead.
I understand it.
Yeah, I know.
Totally,
I understand.
Totally
it. Yeah.
Get it.
Yeah, yeah.
And honestly, when I was writing this book, it wasn't really a thing, and I really felt like I was writing the book to put attention on the genocide in Rwanda and the genocides going on you know, all over the world that white people are really thinking this isn't my thing. You know, people were asking me, I'd written about nonprofits in Africa for years, and I really felt a connection with Africa. I'd been there three times before. I went to Rwanda. I've been there five times altogether now. And people would ask me, including my own parents, you know, why do you write so much about Africa? Why don't you write more about people in your own backyard? And it's like, well, Africa and the whole world is our backyard. We're all connected, particularly with the internet and globalization of businesses and so forth. We're all connected. And so my goal was to connect white people to these stories of that they felt were so foreign to them. Mm-hmm. I didn't really think of it as, you know, appropriation. And then when I started reading about this issue, just really a couple months ago, and I started thinking about it, so for me, I specifically did want the main character in my story, obviously, to be a white woman, because I'm a white woman. And I do believe, as a fiction writer, first rule is write about what you know. But I also spent a lot of time getting to know Rwanda, getting to know the history and the people. And so I feel like spending 11 years writing this novel, not that I would ever assume to know their experience, but I feel like in terms of creating a bridge between cultures, this is the best I can do.
Yeah.
And really, my book is about relationships. It's not really about black or white. It's not, you know, it deals with some racial, with an interracial affair in Atlanta. And so there is definitely, obviously, some racial connection. But I'm not trying to convey the black experience. I'm trying to convey the human experience.
Yeah.
So, right. And I do, I mean, I understand that. It's hard for me to say I understand because I'm not black, but I can imagine being a black person and feeling that a white person cannot know their experience. I totally believe that. I cannot know your experience, Marie. I really can't. You can't know mine. But as a writer, I think that's my challenge, is to try to understand and try to convey the questions that are my demons, which I can only do through taking on different characters, whether they be black or white.
Right.
And if I didn't feel I could do that, I would just write nonfiction all the time, and then it would solve all of the problems. But it's a complicated issue, and it's one that I'm glad you brought up, and different people have very strong opinions about. Some people have strong opinions about, well, men shouldn't write in women's voices, or women shouldn't write in men's voices. And so where do you draw the lines?
Exactly.
And for me, I draw the lines at do no harm and make no assumptions based on things you don't know. And also there's the whole thing of profiting from appropriation, you know, mm-hmm. taking on a story. Like, for example, okay, so I don't write about my characters aren't transgender, you know, because I don't know that experience and I don't understand it well enough to write about it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, for example, Lori Frankel just wrote a book that takes on raising a transgender child, and it's beautiful. It's beautifully done. She's not transgender. To my knowledge, her children aren't transgender, but she does a beautiful job of writing about this, and that's why she's a wonderful fiction writer and very successful one.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I too can see both sides of this issue, and it is complicated, and I just think it's an important one for people to be aware of. This was not an issue when you were trying to sell the book, because I've heard of it being an issue.
It was.
Oh, it was.
I think it was. I think I know at least one editor who it was an issue for, and probably there were other editors who didn't mention it to my agent, but there were also, you know, a handful of editors who loved my book and wanted to take it on. I think it's more an underlying thing. I mean, and so I'm glad people are talking about it, and I'm glad writers are talking about it. And I just think it's important to understand there are no clear right and wrong. It's just something that needs to be talked about, and it's something that writers need to be aware of. And it's something I think, for me, like I said, I draw the line at when you write fiction, there has to be some sort of question you're trying to answer for yourself as an author in some very organic, authentic way. It can't just be about what's going to sell. Well, race is a big issue now. Let me write a book about, you know, racial issues, and I'll have a black character and a white character, and because that's what's going to sell, or transgender or whatever it is. It has to be what really is the question you have about life, and what's the best way you can address that question in fiction.
Right, right. So to that point, who was the character in here that was the most challenging for you, that was the most difficult to bring to life, and sort of how did you grapple with that?
So definitely the most, well, actually, there's two different answers to that. One of the characters who's most difficult, funny, is the main white woman character, Rachel,
because
she originally was me, a white woman going to a foreign land, going to address her own grief without really knowing it, and finding family in a place she wasn't expecting to find family, finding connections with people she wasn't expecting to find connections with. But it took me years, really, to separate myself from Rachel and to let her be her own person. And so since this is kind of a show for writers, I just want to say that I spent a good month just alone with Rachel, just writing in a notebook, sitting in a Barca lounger in front of a fireplace and asking Rachel questions, writing out a web of characters of how is Rachel connected to all these different people and what feels not right about these connections and what would make these connections more real and add tension to them.
Uh-huh.
After I did that, she really came to life. So, and just the other part of that really is that another very difficult person for me to write, some of the Hutus in the book, looking at the what happened from their perspective and finding compassion for them and a way to tell their story in a true, but compassionate way.
I do hear from writers over and over that the person who most resembles them is the person most difficult, the character most difficult to write about. And I'm going to have to think about this more offline of how that plays into our prior discussion of appropriation, because I think there's something in there, but I'm not smart enough to think of it right now.
Well, there totally is. I mean, Start with writing about what you know. Start with writing about what are the questions, like I said, you have that are bedeviling you, and how would that play out in a character who is like you? At the same time, you need to continually search that character and try to find that character's voice. People talk a lot about the voice of a novel, and I think that voice comes from the voice of the characters.
Yeah.
And so there's a very exciting thing that happens as a writer, as a fiction writer, where you all of a sudden realize your character has come to life and they have found their own voice, and they're telling you what they would do, what they wouldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And so that happened to me. It took a long time for that to happen to me with Rachel. It took a very relatively short time for that to happen with Lillian, who's a black woman in her early 50s, because her story to me was so interesting about having an interracial relationship in Atlanta, deciding to go to Africa to help one child at a time because she was disillusioned with the civil rights era, being in Africa and having trouble with finding her place there, this whole relationship with Henry, a white man who comes to Africa then to find her, and their troubles with starting an orphanage in Rwanda, and then the genocide starts. And, you know, it's like I just found Lillian fascinating, and I never I didn't, after a while, think about her as being black.
Uh-huh.
She was just Lillian. I mean, she was just this person who was going through all this stuff. And so the issue of her race kind of went away. And the same thing happened with Nadine, who is the young Tutsi woman. And I didn't think about her being black. I thought about her as being a woman whose family had been murdered during a genocide, a woman who was struggling with losing a friend, a Hutu friend who was part of the massacre at the church where her family was murdered, and trying to find forgiveness for her friend when, you know, is forgiveness possible? That's her big question. And so for me, it wasn't about race.
You also have to conquer, we don't have time for this whole discussion, but you also have to conquer the idea of, is it the same to be to write about a black person in the United States versus a black person living in an indigenous environment where everyone else is black? Their experience is going to be very different vis-a-vis the culture that they're bumping up against and the restraints they're bumping up against, informing their race and their view of themselves. I think that's a complicated question, but and one we don't have time to address. But
yeah, that is really a fascinating question. It's something I'll think about.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to unpack there. Before we sign off, I'd also love to ask you about journalism, if that was a help or a hindrance to fiction writing, what journalism brought to fiction, and maybe what made it more complicated for you.
Well, it's funny because when I first started writing fiction, I started writing in a workshop I went to with a local writer, and she called me a recovering journalist. And I was a recovering journalist for a long time because in journalism, you're taught to put up walls and to write objectively. And in fiction, you're breaking down walls and you're writing subjectively. And it is very difficult. It was difficult for me to make that transition also because I didn't want to expose myself. I mean, for so long, I was able to be the one asking questions and writing about other people's interesting lives. And now suddenly, it really was about me on the page, especially before my characters found their voices and became real people. It had to come from me, and I had to write about what I knew. For me, it was a hindrance. I know other people, though, who they write historical fiction and they start with a real character, you know, like Georgia O'Keeffe or Louisa May Alcott, or, you know, and then they spin out fiction from that real person's life. And I'm like, yeah, that's a great idea. I wish I enjoyed doing that, you know?
Right.
I mean, Nadine started from a real person in Africa, but I didn't know, you know, that I met in Rwanda, but I really didn't know that much about this person's life except that she'd come back for a trial.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I still do some. I don't really do journalism anymore. I do essay writing,
okay.
I pretty much turned off my journalism part of my brain.
Okay, yeah, that's probably more helpful. We're out of time, but any last minute words of advice, wisdom for writers, things gleaned along the way that have helped you?
No, I would just say start with writing about what you know, and read a lot, and discover more so that you know more and you can write more. And I'm also going to put this interview up on my Facebook page and try to have more of a discussion about the whole appropriation issue and get more ideas from different people, from different people of different backgrounds, because I think it's a fascinating topic.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, Marie. It was really great talking to you.
Thank you. And let us know where we can find you online. You have a website, Jennifer Haupt?
Yeah, it's www.jenniferhaupt.com. And then on Facebook, too, it's just Jennifer Haupt. Don't go to my author page because I never do anything there. Just go to my personal page.
You do. You have some wonderful stuff up there. You have a great essay up there today in Oprah Magazine, yeah?
Yeah, that one was really hard to write about my therapist who basically held me emotional hostage for 2 years.
There's much more to discover about you is what I will say. So check Jennifer out online. Jennifer, thanks so much.
Okay, take care, Marie. Bye-bye.
You too. That was Jennifer Haupt. The book, In the Shadow of 10,000 Hills, is out and available now. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned for more awesome programming on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we will be right back here with you next week. So join us next Wednesday at 9 a.m. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.